Right, everyone got that? I'm sure you have. I meant to print out 40 and I think I ended up printing out 80, so we have a few spares if you need. Right, I just have to sort myself out here. Yeah, it's not quite sure what was going to happen with this talk. No surprises there, eh? And I'm sure I've bitten off way more than I can possibly chew in half an hour. The reason that I've given you all sheets is because there is no way we can get through this in half an hour. It's just, it's such a deep, profound subject material that all I can possibly do is give you general broad brush strokes of what this is about. My reason for wanting to do it is that having had quite a few conversations with people recently, especially people that are newer to coming along and newer to the Buddha's teaching, and because of the very subtle body language I get on Wednesday nights whenever I mention the word rebirth, it's like the elephant in the room syndrome. You know, oh, we're going to talk about that, are we? And I thought, we need to talk about rebirth. As a bit of preamble, I was reading today, as it happens, about the difference between the right side and the left side of the brain. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the left side of the brain, the left hemisphere, deals with the nuts and bolts of life. It's very analytical, it's very practical, logical, systematic. The right side of the brain, the right hemisphere, that is your more creative side, your more intuitive side. And I think what our society at the moment is very much more geared up towards the left hemisphere, to the detriment of the right hemisphere. So very scientific, very logical. We, you know, being rational and logical is very much at the centre of people's thoughts, especially when it comes to matters of truth, matters of the way in which life works. And I think that it is an imbalance. I think you need, for a happy life, and especially for meditation, you need a balance between your left and right hemispheres, because you do need the intuitive side. Meditation combines the analytical, the ability to split life up and look at the order of things. It also requires, we're looking at our subjective experience in meditation. And that requires us to investigate using the right side of the brain as well. Insights are, they're not intuitions, but they are intuitive, if that makes any sense. There's no doubt when somebody gains insight into tonight's subject that it is undoubtedly true, it is undoubtedly real, it is not some mad speculation. It is actually the case that they see that it is true. For instance, I will get onto tonight's subject in a minute. As an example, I guess, I hope, all of us has experienced love towards parents, perhaps, or towards husband or wife, or especially towards children. It's a good chance. Yeah. Can you prove it? Can you prove that you love them? Does an external display prove that you love them? Doesn't really, because you could just be making it up. The point I'm making is that you know you love them. There's no doubt about that, but you can't possibly prove you love them because it's a subjective experience. You can't put love on a table and measure it and say, my love is 15 foot long. Can you? It weighs this amount. And when it comes to the matter of things like rebirth, people want proof. Well, you will be getting proof. But you won't be getting proof tonight. I'm only going to give you ideas tonight. The proof comes from meditating. But you are looking at your own subjective experience So don't think you're going to be able to prove it to other people. But the point I'm making is you will prove it because you will see it, that it is so in your own experience.
Okay.
Right. Paticca Sammapada. Condition-dependent origination. Everyone has to know about this. If you're a Buddhist meditator, if you're practicing Vipassana, you need to know about this. And again, I state, all I can do is give you a general overview. Paticca Sammapada, condition-dependent origination, is what the Buddha discovered when he became enlightened. He discovered the Four Noble Truths. He discovered the endless nature of existence. It has no beginning and no ending. He actually transcended the whole notion of time. He realized the timelessness of Nibbana. And so when he put his teaching together, it contains as an absolutely integral part of what he taught these 12 links of condition dependent origination. We need to just quickly go over what we mean by conditionality. Conditionality means that one thing cannot exist unless there's a whole bunch of other things that are there to enable it to exist. If either one of those things or those things are not there, then that thing does not exist. So there is a dependency upon other things for that one thing to exist. So a really easy example would be a tree. A tree needs sunlight, it needs rain, it needs nutrients coming up from the earth. If it doesn't have those things, it cannot survive, it dies. So that's a very general example of conditionality. In meditative terms, we might consider seeing itself, seeing visible objects. Seeing is dependently originated. It arises due to conditions. If the conditions aren't there, seeing does not take place. For instance, if there is no light, seeing doesn't take place. If there is no visible object to observe, seeing doesn't take place. It needs the sensitive matter of the physical eye. You know, you've got all those millions and millions of cones, I don't know what they're called, and they're receptors and they take in the light waves. If that sensitivity of the eye base is not there, if the physical eye is not working, seeing does not happen. Do you get what I mean? It's like you need those things to be there. Right. Paticca Sammapada. The reason that the Buddha taught these 12 links was to show us how it is that suffering comes into being due to conditions. And that if you understand those conditions and you see through what is causing those conditions to arise and you eliminate them, the suffering ceases. So just in the same way that if you don't feed the tree, if the tree doesn't get the sunlight, if it doesn't get the water, if it doesn't get the nutrients, it will cease. In the same way, suffering will cease if we stop feeding it all the things that create the suffering. Okay. Now, let's take it from the beginning. You've got number one. Now, let's not worry about all the external, all these boxes with all this information in, because that's going to get really complicated. I'm going to have to go through it really, really quickly because we haven't got that much time. We begin with ignorance. Ignorance of the way life really is. Ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Ignorance of the reality of condition-dependent origination. Ignorance of things like things don't last. Ignorance of that. And I have to say, more fundamentally even than that, the basic ignorance upon which all suffering arises is an assumption of our separateness. Assumption that I am a separate being from the universe I inhabit. So in ignorance, there is a basic duality that's created. That duality is a delusion. But under the spell of that delusion, We find ourselves, as it were, thrown out of heaven, and we're trying to make life perfect all the time. We feel very dissatisfied with the way life is. We feel unfulfilled. We feel this sense that there's something missing. And there is this constant striving, this constant acting in order to make life perfect, to make it what we want it to be. Now that activity is what here is number two, kamma formations. Yeah? So kamma means action. So the formation of actions that are primarily about trying to bring that sense of fulfillment, of wholeness, a cessation of suffering. Yeah? Those actions only occur because of that ignorance of our true nature and the assumption of this duality. Now, the law is, and this is what the Buddha discovered, that whenever an action is taken with a view of self, so with this delusion in place, it always has to produce a result. It always has to produce a result. That's the law of kamma. Where there's an action taken with a view of self, it always has to produce a result. So how do we experience results? We have to be conscious. What are the results that we experience? Well, we experience results in terms of sensory contacts, in terms of the feelings that arise due to those sensory contacts, and the perceptions that arise. So for instance, this evening you said, perhaps to yourself, I must go to the House of Inner Tranquility and listen to a talk on Buddhism tonight. Now you're here, and you're experiencing the results of those actions in terms of sensory contacts, feelings that arise as a consequence, and the perceptions that arise as a consequence. Now you can only experience those because you're conscious, and you can only be conscious if there's a mind and body to be conscious with, and the sense media of eye and ear and body and nose and tongue and so forth, in order to experience it. Have I lost everyone, or is everyone with me? To go through it again, because it's critical. It's critical that you understand this. We are all of us at the moment experiencing resultant, what we call resultant consciousness. We can only do that because there's a body with a sense media of eye and ear and so forth. All right. So, kamma formations require resultant consciousness. So, consciousness is number three. For there to be consciousness, there has to be what here is written as mentality and corporeality. Let's call it mind and body. There has to be a mind and body for consciousness to arise. In order to experience results, there have to be the six sense bases of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So in order to experience resultant consciousness, to experience the impressions, the sensory impressions, and the feelings that arise out of those sensory impressions, you have to have mind and body. So it's because of the law of kamma, because the law states that you have to experience the results of your actions, that mind and body come into being. Okay. Again, moving on quite quickly. I'd love to dally, but I can't. It is in response to feelings that we act. So having experienced sense contacts and the feelings that those sense contacts produce, with this sense of self that we believe is real, we experience pleasant contacts, which we then lose, and we want to get them back or get more of them. We experience painful feelings, and we don't want those, so we try to get rid of those. That is kamma, that is action. Okay. So having gone through a passive phase of experiencing these sense contacts, these feelings and perceptions, wanted and unwanted, then there is a craving, the desire for life to be different than it is, that arises in response. As a result of craving, we keep on craving. We keep on saying, no, it should be different, it should be different, it should be different. And we start to create what we call clinging attachment to ideas of exactly how it should be different and why it should be different. And that's where all the justifications and condemnations come in, and everything becomes a lot more intense. So it's clinging is intensified craving. And it's that intensified craving that causes us to actually act out and try to make life different. And we call that becoming. So there's a process of actually manipulating the world in order to make it conform to our ideas of what it should be. Right? So that's your craving, clinging, and becoming. Number 8, number 9, and number 10. So that's fresh action. All of that is part of karma formations. That's new actions designed to get a particular result. As a consequence of that, it is inevitable that there has to be future birth, because you have to experience the results of your actions, and there has to be consciousness. Okay. So given that, and what is that birth? Well, that's the birth of new mind and body, new sense bases, in order to allow conscious experiencing to occur again, so you can experience the results of your actions. And we know, and this was the Buddha's great discovery, that birth is the single most necessary condition for the arising of suffering. If you're born, it's inevitable you're going to die. If you're born, it's inevitable. It's a shame, but it is the case that there's going to be sorrow, lamentation, grief, pain, and despair. It's inevitable. There's nothing you can do about it. The fact that there is a body, given the conditions as they are, it's inevitable that there'll be suffering. This was the Buddha's great discovery. He also went backwards, and he took it in his mind, he went backwards, and he said, well, okay, the fact of suffering, what is the necessary condition for suffering? It's birth. What does birth require for it to occur? Prior becoming. What does prior becoming require for it to occur? Prior clinging, prior craving, prior feeling, prior sense contact, prior sense bases, prior mind and body, prior consciousness. So it all comes all the way back to ignorance. Ignorance of the true nature of reality. So what he discovered was there is this endless process. Because even with when we're suffering, we're not sort of calmly sitting back and going, oh yes, I can see, it's because I'm craving, isn't it? And we're going, wah! And we're ignoring reality at that time. Well, that's what I do. You might do something else. But the point is that when we're suffering, we're not in a position to observe the deep truths of reality as they're unfolding. So we're ignoring. Where there's craving, there's always ignoring. And where there's craving, there's always suffering. So this loop is ongoing. And although ignorance is taken out and given its own link as, you know, in position number one, the underlying cause of all suffering, it is there latent in every moment of consciousness. Because in every moment of consciousness, dualistic consciousness, there is this assumption of my own separateness. So it is a never-ending process of always acting, trying to reach this point of conclusion, of rest, of perfect being, always falling short because the nature of dualistic existence is inherently unsatisfactory. And so you find you're always acting, you're always becoming, you're always trying to do this, trying to do this, trying to do this. You can never get off the wheel, the samsaric wheel, the wheel of condition-dependent origination, by acting, through action. Now, given that this process has no beginning and no end, it means that the idea of rebirth is the most accurate description of how life works. It's far more accurate than this idea that there was nothing, and then I appeared, and then I acted, and then at the end of 60, 70, 80 years, there is nothing. because it doesn't take into account the cyclical nature and the endless nature of this action and result, cause and effect. Neither does some notion of an eternal heaven, that we die from this existence and then there is an eternal existence, an unchanging eternal existence, because we see through, especially when we get onto the meditation, we see that life is arising and passing away. There is no static, durable moment in any of it. In the grand scheme of things, being open to the idea of rebirth does do quite a lot in settling our minds. It really does help to explain why it is that we're all so different, based on the same template and yet all remarkably different. Why people have some people have what seem like extremely lucky births into good circumstances, and others seem to have to face great difficulties. If it is that there was prior action that gave rise to life in this life, then it makes sense that it has something to do with their actions that affected the kind of conditions that they found themselves in this life. If someone is open to the idea of rebirth, that does tend towards far greater acceptance of their conditions, whether their conditions were good or bad or however they saw them. It does tend towards greater acceptance and therefore a reduction in craving, because the person says, well, that's just the way it was. I must have acted in a way that must have prompted those kind of resultants. And the other wonderful aspect of rebirth is the fact that it actually gives us power. It gives us power over our future. Because if you are willing to take responsibility for your, in a sense, take responsibility for your past actions, and say, well, my current situation is the result of past actions, then my future, whatever that future holds, is dependent on my volitional behaviour now. So it's up to me. It's up to how I choose to behave. And the law, I know you're all aware of this, but the law of karma states that actions that are out and out selfish tend towards more and more painful resultants. Actions which are relatively unselfish tend towards more pleasant resultants. So no matter what's going on in the world, in Syria or the Ukraine, and it all seems so terrible and there's all the floods and everything, if someone is behaving, by and large, living by the precepts, developing the parami, developing their practice of loving kindness and generosity and all these sorts of things, if they're practicing meditation, if they're being of service to their fellow beings, then all of that is securing a good future, irrespective of what else is happening in the world. So we can really become masters of our own destiny in that sense. But of course, none of that action will actually get you off the wheel. Now, we want proof. Everybody wants proof of karma and rebirth. I think the idea is that we take paticca-samuppada, the links of condition-dependent origination, we learn them, we understand intellectually what they are, and then we learn to observe our experience. Now, in terms of what we can observe, anybody can observe, you see you've got on your diagram, you've got areas of darker and areas of lighter. Oh, no, that's not what I mean. You've got future, past and present written there. Now, in that shoehorn of present, everything that falls within, all the links that fall within that, so that's from number 3 to number 10, from resultant consciousness all the way to becoming, that is all present experience. Right? So anybody if you practice mindfulness, you can see that, and you're properly labeling your experience as you go along, and gradually you're clarifying all the different elements of your experience, and you're beginning to recognize the difference between craving and consciousness and feeling and sense contacts and all these things. From number 3 to number 10, that's all present. You can see the whole of condition-dependent origination working there. If you also take into consideration that the past, you've only got 2 links for the past. You're looking at your sheets, I hope so. If you were to explode that out and look at that in more detail, you would get all the links from consciousness. You'd get the links from craving to becoming. Yeah. So in your present experience, you'll be able to see what it is, the sorts of things that occurred in the past to bring you into this particular state. And also, when you look at the future, you've got birth, death and decay. Well, you can look at that in your experience too, because that's going from consciousness to feeling. So even though you are only actually dealing with your present, so how many is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of those links in present experience, it actually tells you the story of the past and the future too. Practical examples of what I mean. I always use this example. I have to try and think of some more. You spend time sitting at home, thinking really irritable thoughts, lots of ill will about somebody you know. I don't suggest it as an exercise, but technically you could. We all have. You walk down the street a little bit later and you see that person. Sense contact, consciousness. What is it that you experience by way of feelings and perceptions? You feel, probably have unwanted perceptions, oh, it's that person, and painful feelings. Those are not imbued in that person. They are the results of that prior activity. Yeah? Equally, you could sit at home thinking about what a wonderful person that is and all their good qualities and wishing them well and hope they become enlightened and at peace and everything. Now, you see that person walking down the street. Consciousness, sense impressions, resultant consciousness. What comes up by way of feelings and perceptions? You're happy to see them. Wanted perception, pleasant feelings. That is condition-dependent origination actually being observed as it unfolds. Okay. Another example. I didn't write down another example. Oh, very remiss of me. So in a meditation, and you're absolutely furiously watching the breath, trying to hold the mind on the breath and not let it go, what would you expect to experience as resultants of that? Extreme headaches, tension, dissatisfaction, sense of failure. Pretty miserable state, and people do that. Somebody else, recognizing that the whole point is to acknowledge what thoughts come up, label them, then come back to the breath, and then move on to the next thing. So they take a completely different attitude towards the meditation. It's very peaceful. It's not goal-orientated. It's not furiously self-obsessed about getting somewhere. What kinds of results would you expect? A sense of calmness, flexibility of mind, happy to let things come and let things go, greater chance of being concentrated, greater chance of being peaceful. Whatever aspect of the Buddha's training that you pick up, and this is the great difference between treating this as an intellectual exercise, you know, like you can know there are 5 precepts, you can know there are 10 parami. But if you actually keep the precepts and actually develop the parami, you actually experience the results of those actions. Yeah, make sense? So if somebody keeps the precepts, as a result of that, they feel good about themselves, they feel like life is benevolent, they feel, you know, lucky in life. If they develop the parami, then those resultants are expanded further and deepened further. So it's by direct observation, through direct involvement with the training, that one actually sees the reality of Paticcasamuppada. It's not airy-fairy, it's not wishy-washy. The whole idea of rebirth is not, it's not just mere superstition. It's these things are real and they can be apprehended. But still, proof of rebirth? The whole point of insight meditation is to keep looking at the fact, once you're free of hindrances and you're paying attention and you're labelling experiences as they come and go, you're beginning to become more lucid and being able to identify even more, ever more subtle aspects of your experience, you come to see that there is nothing durable in any of it. There is nothing in existence which persists from this moment to this moment. Everything arose and passed away, keeps on arising and passing away. Now, the appearance of things is that things remain the same. That the people I'm looking at now are the same as the ones that I looked at just a few nanoseconds ago. But when you look with insight, you see that the deep reality is that that is not the case. That life comes into being due to conditions, a whole multitude of conditions. Life arises, consciousness arises, and then they all cease, with no remainder at all. And that is the huge difference in understanding that you get from practicing insight meditation. And that is really pertinent, because it shows you that when you choose, this is going to sound silly, but when you choose to do something as simple as open a door, that the whole of life actually comes into being in order for you to for that process to happen. That is a completely spontaneous arising of existence in that moment. There is nothing, there is in reality nothing persisting of me that goes from this moment and walks up to the door and opens it. Materiality and mentality arise and pass away moment by moment. There is nothing of duration in any of it. When you see that in meditation, that it's all arising due to conditions, that there's nobody doing it, it's all utterly spontaneous, it is resultant consciousness arising, and there's nothing that anyone can do to stop that, it is just happening, and then it immediately arises and passes away. What you get from that is a direct insight into condition-dependent origination. Everything's arising and passing away due to conditions. It's not controllable. It's all non-self. But the point is that there is a precise insight that arises, which is the direct inference. It is an inference, but it is a direct inference based on the reality of what you're seeing, that it's always been like that, and it always will. And that, although the words come out and you think, oh, great, okay. When you actually experience that, that then throws the whole of condition-dependent origination into context. You suddenly see that all this resultant consciousness is arising due to past actions, because you see also the actions that you then produce, which is going to create more resultant consciousness. This is not left hemisphere stuff, this is right hemisphere stuff. This is stuff of insight. But it is just as real as your love for your children. And when you see it, You know it is the case. You know it is thus. And it's in that way that somebody comprehends the truly beginningless, endless nature of condition-dependent origination. Good. So I know it's tricky stuff, but it is as real as the law of music is real. Do you think that at some point somebody's going to come up with a new note? H or something. Or in the colour spectrum they're going to suddenly come up with a new colour. Isn't it the case that the laws of music have always been the way they are? Isn't it the case that the colour spectrum has always been the way it is? Those basic fundamental laws of existence. And that's what makes Buddha Dhamma so profound. Because when you clear the mind up and you actually start looking, you realise that you have the deepest, most fundamental understanding of the way life actually works. This is not playing bongos in a muddy field. This is a lot, you know, it's not about wearing rainbow coloured jumpers on. Do you know what I mean? This is, or eating lentils. Do you know what I mean? This is, I think I'm making my point. So all that's required for somebody, if somebody has got a completely closed mind to the idea of rebirth, the meditation just isn't going to do anything. Because it's going to put that view under intense pressure. If somebody merely has an open attitude to the possibility of rebirth, that's all that's required. Because that openness then allows somebody to meditate and observe the truth of things for themselves. Because you don't have to, you know, the other thing, I mean, it's such a left hemisphere world we live in, you know, you don't have to wear a badge saying I believe in rebirth. It's not necessary. And you don't have to convince anybody. The Buddha said, I don't argue with anyone. The world argues with me. The point is simply is to have an openness of spirit, to enter into these 12 links of dependent origination and actually observe the reality for yourself with insight. And anyone can come to find out the reality for themselves. The whole purpose, the underlying purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to eradicate link number one, ignorance. If you eradicate ignorance, then karma formations can't come up. And then resultant consciousness can't come up. And then mind and body. And then, so all the links collapse if you deal with the underlying ignorance. And that's why we meditate. That's why we practice mindfulness. Yeah? Of course, that does sort of leave us in a somewhat tricky position because that, whoa, no mind and body? What? What? What do you mean, no mind and body? That's annihilation, isn't it? No, it isn't. When the ignorance is let go of, then there is total comprehension of non-duality. I mean, total comprehension of the whole and the total recognition that there aren't any bits at all. So it's non-dual. So to be aware of sense contacts, feelings, consciousness, there has to be this duality, this sense of me in opposition to the things I'm looking at. Yeah? So non-duality is just the absence of two. So there is no way to describe. There is no way to explain non-duality. And people look at the Buddha and say, hey, you're there, I can see you, mind and body, you're there. To help people, the Buddha talked about enlightenment with the aggregates, with mind and body remaining, and then at the time when the physical body ceases, enlightenment without the aggregates. And that's the closest he could get to it. But actually for the enlightened being, the subjective experience is totally of non-duality. For the enlightened being, there is no sense of being two. It is all non-dual. So it is impossible to really describe what it feels like. And the beauty of the Buddha's teaching is, so we don't have to describe it. What we do is focus on eradicating the ignorance. You have to have a certain amount of faith, but that faith is really driven by the suffering, is conditioned, dare I say it, by the suffering that is inherent in that delusion of duality.